Oh.
Check, check. Mic check.
Oh, no,
I just
no,
like,
you're fine.
Can't hear myself. Or anyone.
But you can't. So it sounds like your headphones aren't plugged in. Are they plugged in?
Oh, yeah. They're not plugged in. Wow, look at yourself.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up, and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got Tebow. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538, and with me in the studio, it's Neil Statman Payne. Hi, Neil.
Hey, Chad.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing well, and along with us in the studio, it's not Kate Fagan, who is, quote, out of the country, mysteriously.
Yeah, that's odd.
But instead, it's 538 Sports writer and the Lenny Harris of Hot Takedown, Kyle Wagner. Hi, Kyle.
Hey,
Kyle. Chad. Very excited for your first full show, I think, right?
Yeah, I think this is it.
I know that you're excited to talk about baseball most.
I'm going to have a lot to contribute. Yes.
Good. Excellent.
So you are the Lenny Harris
of
the podcast.
I have no idea. None.
Of all the former Mets you could have compared him to.
He's the pinch hitter.
Yeah.
The great pinch hitter. All right.
Best of all time.
Speaking of baseball, on today's show, we're going to talk about the Cubs. What is wrong with them? If anything, they are only a game over 500 at the part of the season that Neil says we're finally allowed to start believing that things are real.
I don't believe I ever said that.
You said a third of the way through.
I think it wasn't it 70 games? That's like about halfway through.
Neil, give me this intro.
Okay, Chad. Sorry.
And then after that, we're going to talk about the NFL's new overtime rules, which have just been approved on Tuesday. NFL owners have voted to reduce overtime to 10 minutes instead of 15. And we'll discuss whether their stated reason, which was that it was for player safety, holds any water. But first, we are going to talk about the NBA and those Warriors who just keep winning. Half of the NBA finals are set. The Warriors are through. They have not lost a game yet this playoffs. They're 12-0, the first team in NBA history to be 12-0 going into the finals. Now, that's partly because of the way the NBA series have worked, but still the first 12-0 playoff team. And so I thought we could spend some time talking about the Western Conference Finals that were, both the Warriors and how dominant they've looked, and also maybe say goodbye to Manu Ginobili, because it's a sad thing to say goodbye to Manu. You ready for that, Kyle?
We're still not sure he's all the way at the door.
Okay.
But,
all right. So let's start with the Warriors, maybe. Neil, when do we get to start talking about this team as like one of the all-time greats?
Why not now? I mean, we talked at the end of the regular season about how sort of sneakily, despite the fact that last year's Warriors had the win record and all these things, that this year's Warriors won by a larger margin per 100 possessions and like all the little kind of stat indicators that us sabermetric types like to look at. This Warriors team was a better team on paper than the record-shattering version from last year or the champions from 2 years ago. So they've only been even better in the playoffs so far. And if you look at the differential per 100 possessions that they put up in the playoffs, which Basketball Reference has for playoff seasons going back to 1983, they are beating opponents by 16.4 points per 100 possessions, which is the most of any team in the database. And second of all time is that 2001 Lakers team that also went into the finals undefeated, and they only won by an average of 13.8 points per 100 possessions. And then third is the 91 Bulls. So we really are looking at a team that has kind of fulfilled its destiny so far in terms of what we talked about the possibilities for it after they added Kevin Durant in the offseason, which is being the best team of all time and kind of ending that conversation.
But, I mean, that conversation has been over for a while, right? If the question is when are we going to start talking about them as, you know, one of the best ever, we have been. We have been since last season. And to me, it just seems like people kind of want to say that the Warriors aren't getting their due, but it feels more like, to me, people have been given them their due and are just uninterested
is
by it now.
Is it Warriors fatigue by now, I guess?
Well, just like the question is an obvious answer. Like, yes, they're one of the best of all time, and now we want to see what happens with LeBron.
One of, I mean, I guess the only way to answer the question of kind of being the would be to win the championship. And even then, you would have the 96 Bulls kind of loyalists that would say, oh, well, they didn't win the championship the same year that they set the wins record and this, that, and the other. But I think if you're just looking at the numbers, this team makes a really strong case. This particular 2017 team, just putting aside the previous two versions of it, which are also in the same conversation, as being like the greatest team of all time, full stop. And if they win the championship, I mean, that's kind of a difficult case to argue against.
True.
Yeah, to me, it, from, you know, not necessarily being as close of a watcher of the NBA as either of you, it seems as though Kawhi Leonard's injury, for example, is something that like took maybe some of the air out of the impressive sweep that we just saw, and Durant being injured, and like there are a few different things that happened this season that sort of, I think, threw the Warriors' dominance into question relative to other past historically dominant teams. But that's maybe just naive of me from the outside to think like, wait, this team has won every game, but like they couldn't actually be that good, right? There's almost like a stress test kind of thing that I'm putting to it.
Maybe, but then we give the 2001 Lakers kind of a free pass in that regard for practically the entire regular season. They that season, during the regular season, they only won 56 games, which was an 11-win decline from the previous year because Shaq was hurt, and they just, you know, kind of paced themselves throughout the year, and then they unleashed the unholy fury in the playoffs. This Warriors team paced itself less in terms of how they played in the regular season, and they've played better in the playoffs.
Right. I mean, well, that's what we would have gotten into with the Cavs then, if the Cavs had continued and, you know, not, you know, given up game three.
Right.
To just obliterate the entire league and, you know, rolled into the playoffs and, like, perhaps won against this greatest team of all time. But, I mean, sadly, we don't have that anymore. But, I mean, if they drop one game on the way to the finals and it's by a few points and then they have their, what is it, 17-point differential, like, coming in? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we should also say the Cavs, for their own part, even though they lost the game the other day to the Celtics, are fourth on that list at Basketball Reference of the most dominating postseason runs. And again, that's not adjusted for strength of competition, which has been an issue for Cleveland during the playoffs, if not, you know, the Warriors.
And yet the Cavs still have just a 7% chance of winning.
according to ELO.
Model. But let's save all the Cavs and Warriors talk for next week, mm-hmm. when presumably we will actually have a Cavs versus Warriors finals to
barring
talk about.
Some kind of miracle.
But I do want to talk about Manu Ginobili, because Kyle, you wrote a piece for 538.com this week that was saying if Manu retires, is, you know, he was one of the stranger, more unique, if you can have degrees of unique, players of all time. And I thought, you know, one of the points you made was really interesting, was that partly it's because he was like a superstar who didn't start in a lot of cases.
Right. And that, you know, obviously shifts his numbers up to be more efficient, because when you're asked to do less, you tend to, you know, have much better numbers efficiency wise. We're seeing that with Kevin Durant. We see that obviously with Russell Westbrook, because he's asked to do so much, and that keeps his efficiency down relative to, you know, what we think it could be on a different team. But Manu was like kind of in that sweet spot where he played about 27 to 30 minutes a game, and he came in and he gave you basically Kobe Bryant's numbers when he was in the game. We haven't really seen that, because most teams don't have that luxury of having this fantastic player who, even though he might, you know, not be all that durable, and he was not all that durable, especially early in his career, they were able to just keep him in that role that was, you know, best for him, fill out the starting roster with, you know, other shooting guards, other playmaking, and just have him come in that second unit.
And so was that like a radical insight by Popovich, that was the best role for Ginobili? Like, have we seen that model of treating a player like Ginobili before?
I mean, we've seen, you know, good players pushed into that, you know, six-man role.
Generally, when they're older, though, right? I mean, Ginobili was in that role when he was still, like, in his prime. And in his prime, if you look at, like, the per, you know, possession plus-minus numbers, he was, like, a top-five player in the league, like, year in and year out on, like, a rate basis, even though he was logging, like, 26 minutes a night, which is just kind of mind-boggling. I can't think of anyone else that was used so sparingly and was that effective when they did play.
And was that okay with it, too? Because we've seen other players that, you know, get pushed into that six-man role, and they're unhappy about it, but they'll, you know, do it if they're really asked. Andre Iguodala was, you know, not quite the player that Manu was, especially at the point in his career where he was asked to be a six-man. But, you know, even then, he was like, well, I don't love this, but I'll do it if it's better for the team.
And it seems like the team being the Spurs mattered for that, too, where if you have, you know, the lineup and the rotations that the Spurs do, being a super sub is probably better than if you're on some other team where there isn't a cohesive philosophy to the organization. And so I'm sure that had something to do with it as well.
Right. I mean, that obviously helps if you're winning a lot of titles. But, I mean, it's also the way that they used him once he did come in. He was essentially their playmaker on that second unit. And once you got into the latter-day Spurs, especially where it was him and Boris Diaw, where the two of them you were loading up on passing in that second unit, well, those were the reasons that those lineups with, you know, a Corey Joseph or Patty Mills were able to, you know, be so successful, because they were playing point guards that weren't really traditional point guards. George Hill's in there too. And so when they were playing with LaMarcus Aldridge last year, LaMarcus's numbers when he's passed to by Manu are way, way better than when he's passed to, you know, well, Tony Parker was a little bit of an exception, but in the starting lineup, LaMarcus performs much, much worse. Boban Marinovic, when he's set up by anyone but Manu or in like last year, and Boris last year, wasn't quite the same player, which he was an efficiency monster when he was, you know, playing with those two.
So are there players that like are starting right now that would be better if they just would take the Manu treatment? You know, are there people around the league that Ginobili should be a model for and sort of like, listen, we're going to cut your minutes down by 10 minutes per game, but you're going to be playing against inferior lineups and you're going to be the playmaker on our second unit. As a result, your numbers are either going to stay flat or get better.
Well, there probably isn't a player in the league that wouldn't, you know, do so much better if they were.
I mean,
able
someone
to
who's struggling, in the starting five, for example, and who, you know, is like taking that step back is probably better for the team because they'd actually have more of an impact on the second unit.
Yeah, and I mean, that's kind of goes back to what we were talking about, a luxury that the Spurs had, because, for instance, like Kawhi Leonard early in his career also played kind of, you know, in that sort of sub, you know, under 25 minutes a night role, and then when he did kind of become the player that we think of as him now, as he kind of grew into that role more, the temptation to use him as a starter and have him log huge minutes overrode anything else, even for Pop, who had shown this tendency in the past. So it's tough to think of non-big men that sort of can stay in that role for a long time. And the big men that do it are like super effective on a minute basis, but they usually foul too damn much to stay in the lineup, and that's less of an issue for perimeter players traditionally.
I mean, we saw it a little bit this year with Eric Gordon in Houston, who was in a bench role and did really, really well for them. But I mean, it's also just a luxury thing. Most teams don't have the starting lineups that, you know, can hold down the fort while you wait for one of your best players to come in off the bench.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things for the Spurs in recent incarnations is that their bench has been like such a killer unit, and really not. And most teams just kind of ask their bench to sort of hold serve while the starters get a rest, and then kind of, you know, fill in you know, the gaps in between. But in the case of the Spurs, they would actually kind of run up a lot of their differential with the second units on the floor, and that was sort of like a secret weapon for them. And so maybe you would see a move where a team, if they do want to kind of take advantage of that, they feel like, well, our starting five isn't that good, but maybe we have a player who's only slightly less good than our, you know, one of our best players, slot that person into the starting five, and then try to just kind of run up as many points as possible with the starters of each team on the bench. That might be like a sneaky strategy, maybe. I don't know.
I mean, so a role like this is also where you see a lot of experimentation. So early on, like, Manu was in, like, those constipated old Spurs with, you know, Nazi Muhammad and, you know, whatever. And, he would come in and he was just like flashing to the rim and, you know, crashing into everybody. And then as we, you know, developed, you know, better stats, we realized, oh yeah, flashing to the rim and crashing into everyone and shooting these crazy threes, actually that's maybe the way to play basketball. So if you look at his free throw rate and his three-point attempt rate, he was right up there just behind like Chauncey Billups as one of those guys who was, you know, doing what we now think you're supposed to do.
Yeah, a little like what we talked about with Paul Pierce a few weeks ago also, like predicting the future of the game.
Mm-hmm. So now, like, the guys that you see in these short minutes might be guys that are doing that are really, really effective, might be doing things that, like, in a few years down the road, we're going to say, oh, well, yeah, maybe we should have been throwing the ball, you know, 20 feet in the air to JaVale McGee many more times than we already were.
All right. Good night, Manu, sweet prince. Maybe next year we'll do this all over again, but probably not. It's been a pleasure. And goodbye, Spurs. I feel like every year it's a goodbye, Spurs, and I always feel a little sad when their sort of quixotic attempt to make a run against the immovable object of immovable windmill of the Warriors doesn't quite work out. All right, from NBA to baseball. Kyle, are you ready?
It's my favorite sport.
All right, good. Kyle is our resident, what do you call yourself, dumb baseball person within 538, asking occasional dumb baseball questions?
Yes, yes, the regularly scheduled baseball idiot questions.
Yes, baseball idiot, excuse me. So we are here to talk about the Chicago Cubs. They won the World Series last year, Kyle, and the World Series is a tournament at the end of the year. So the Cubs are only one game above 500 despite being forecast as world beaters. Coming into this year, they're third in the NL Central. They're only 2.5 games back, but third, the surprising Milwaukee Brewers and the unstoppable force of Eric Thames are in first in the division. And so I want to talk a little bit about what's going on for the Cubs. And Neil, you wrote a bit about that for 538, but I want to set the scene just a little bit more. When you take into account just the number of runs scored versus allowed, which is the Pythagorean win-loss that you hear about sometimes from us and from other sabermetric stat folks, they're still third in the division. And so that doesn't necessarily explain it, that they're not just getting unlucky, for example, at least so far, based on just runs scored versus runs allowed. But when you take into account strength of opponent, and this is based on Baseball Prospectus's calculations, all of a sudden they're second in the division, and barely behind the Cardinals, when you take all that into account. And so, Neil, is this a matter of luck? Is this a matter of people not playing to the level that they were playing to last year? What answer this riddle for the people of Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit of luck because, like you mentioned, the Pythagorean numbers, they are still winning fewer games than you would expect based on their runs scored and allowed, slightly fewer. So that's a little bit of it. And I think one of the bigger things is luck in terms of batting average on balls in play. BABIP, we talk about this a lot, of this is probably the most volatile stat or one of the most volatile stats in baseball, and that goes for hitters as well as pitchers, but especially for pitchers. So on the hitting side for the Cubs, if you look at like the stuff that shows how well they control the strike zone, how well they're kind of smashing the ball, they're walking just as much as they did last year. They're making contact pretty much as they did last year, and they're hitting for just about as much power as they did last year. The only real difference is that their batting average on balls in play is 14 points lower than it was last year, and that pretty much goes a long way toward explaining why they're not scoring as many runs. And then on the other side, last year's Cubs had this ridiculous defense that allowed a BABIP of 255, which relative to the league was actually the lowest in the history of Major League Baseball.
Suggesting either they're really good defense or got lucky, right?
Right, exactly. And so, again, the stat is like super volatile. We had some evidence that the Cubs pitchers were doing something to induce especially like easily fieldable balls, and that was part of it last year. And certainly their pitchers are less dominant this year than they were last year. They're allowing more home runs. They're walking more people, and that's played a role. And so, you know, they're fielding independent numbers, as we talk about sometimes, just extracting the BABIP part of it, the defense part of it, are a little bit worse than last year. But also, the BABIP has just, you know, risen, and we talk about regressing to the mean. The mean is around 300. 300, and their BABIP allowed this year is exactly 300. So they've lost 45 points of BABIP from last year's version, and a lot of that really is luck. I mean, some of it is playing Kyle Schwarber full-time in left field, not a good defensive player. They lost Dexter Fowler. They replaced him with John Jay, not as good of a center fielder defensively. So there are like some small changes that have taken place and at the individual level, but some of it is just the balls that were finding the gloves a year ago are not finding the gloves this year, and that can wildly vary from year to year.
So as the baseball outsider,
that's one word for it.
my question is this a team that is uniquely susceptible to this kind of bad luck? Because you mentioned Schwarber, and from the little bit I know, he is not your prototypical leadoff hitter, even though he stayed in there. And so does that make it harder to generate offense if you are playing, you know, non-traditional players? So, like, does he not run the base paths as well? Is he not as fast? Like, so you can't, you know, get those tweener runs. And if you're playing him in the field and he's not as strong of a fielder, but you've been relying on this very, very good BABIP, then you don't have very strong fielders out there to, you know, help out with, you know, bat worse luck. Is that any kind of explanation here?
He's definitely slower than the prototypical leadoff hitter has been for the history of baseball, and that's kind of a new development across baseball that we're seeing guys like him, kind of slow power types, be slotted in at the leadoff spot. But we also have evidence that giving more plate appearances in general to your best hitters kind of offsets whatever is lost in terms of, you know, clogging up the base paths, what Joe Morgan used to call when you don't have a lot of speed at the top of the order and you can't kind of score these sort of gimme runs, productive outs, things like that. And in the case of the Cubs, I mean, they are actually receiving a lot of luck in terms of clustering their hits together and sort of having, you know, big innings compared to what you would expect from their, overall number of offensive events like hits and walks and things like that. So if it were a matter of like not being able to score or not being an efficient offense, you'd think it would show up in a stat like the amount of clustering that you have. If anything, they're kind of doing it in an efficient way. It's just their opponents are also, you know, kind of taking advantage of them, and it does come back to me, like you said, the defense just, you know, not being as world beating, that can play a lot of tricks on your overall wins and losses.
So here's a question. Year to year, how does a baseball team get worse at defense?
Well, I think, first of all, some of the personnel changes, like we talked about, have not gone in their favor. And there's just a heavy amount of regression to the mean for not only individual defenders, but for team defense as a whole. If you look at the correlation from year to year of something like BABIP allowed, only about 10% of the variation in a team's BABIP is explained by the previous year's BABIP. And that goes for, if you look at things at the team level, even some of the more advanced stats out there. So it's, you know, about as consistent as something like batting average for individual players, but we've seen batting average jump around like crazy from year to year. And when you kind of put all of these players who individually might be, you know, a moderate amount of randomness from year to year, but you kind of have them together in this organism. I mean, the defense of a baseball team really is this, you know, nine-player group that is sort of working in concert with each other, and each one has the possibility of kind of regressing to the mean. As a whole, it can kind of amplify, and I think in the case we're seeing with the Cubs, that the effect of a bunch of different players who really were not going to repeat the types of years that they had last year coming together, it's sort of less than the sum of its parts in some ways. And I should also say that Schwarber hasn't really hit as well as we would expect from his track record, too. Out of the leadoff slot, he's hitting 190 with a 311 on-base percentage. That's why the Cubs are below average in terms of on-base percentage out of the leadoff slot as a whole, as a team. You got to get on-base percentage out of that slot to have a functioning offense. So that's part of it, too.
And sure enough, Schwarber wasn't in the leadoff slot on Monday when they lost, when the Cubs lost to the Giants, and Ben Zobrist was there instead. And so perhaps the end of that experiment is upon Chicago. All right, so Neil, real quick, before we move on, you're telling me that it's still too early to get to some answers for the Cubs, right? That all this could turn around in a nice 10-game winning streak, and all of a sudden the Cubs, who I got it wrong before, are not one game over 500 right now, but are two games over 500. They turned around, and they're 12 games over 500, and that's that.
Yeah, I mean, the talent on this team is still, you know, the best or one of the best in Major League Baseball, and I don't think that they've, like, shown themselves with that two games over 500 record to be, you know, fraudulent in that department. Yeah, I think they're still one of the best teams. I mean, this is an odd season in which it's kind of topsy-turvy. The teams that you expect to be really good have been kind of mediocre, and there have been some surprise teams that have kind of jumped out. You know, even the Yankees are in that group, but also the Diamondbacks and the Rockies and the Rays and the Brewers. So, you know, I think it's still early, and the Cubs are still, you know, one of the best teams in baseball until we hear otherwise.
All right. That's an optimistic note for the north side of Chicago. Let's leave it there and move on to the NFL. All right, now on to football, where NFL owners today on Tuesday approved a change that is going to shorten overtime to 10 minutes rather than 15 minutes in the league. The stated justification for it was that players, they need to be safer. And so these 5 minutes that you're going to take from overtime games, that's what's going to make them safer. That made us start to wonder how many plays exactly that is. And then we realized that our colleague Kevin Seifert had already done some of that over at ESPN. Kevin joins us now. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. How are you guys?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Thanks for coming on. So, Kevin, just run us through here. You and ESPN Stats and Information work together to sort of look at how many plays happen overall in an NFL season, how many plays happen over a five-minute time span, and then, you know, what percentage of plays we're really taking away in this effort to, for player safety.
Yeah, so I guess the place to start is that last year there was about 32,000 plays in an NFL season, and so that gives you an idea of what a typical modern NFL season has, give or take a few each year. And so in order to try to look and see whether this is actually going to have any impact whatsoever on player safety, we thought the best way to do it is to see how many of those plays occur after the 10-minute mark, basically, of overtime. And so you have to look first at how many games have gone to overtime, and we had numbers back to 1974, and there were about 540 games that went to overtime. 133 of those went past the 10-minute mark, so less than a quarter of that. We had numbers on how many plays occurred after that 10-minute mark going back to 2001, so a pretty good 15, 16-year window there. And we found that it was an average of about 5.5 to 6 plays per game that went past the 10-minute mark. And so you put all those numbers together and throw them into the calculator, and you come up with basically a projection that over the course of an entire season, by reducing overtime from 15 minutes to 10 minutes, you would probably cut a grand total of about 20 to 22 plays from an NFL season. And
from all teams.
All teams, all games, everything, all players. It's about 2,000 players over the course of a season who put on a uniform for at least one game. So you're talking about 20 out of 32,000 plays that would be reduced. And obviously that's not I mean, I guess you could make an argument that some injuries are more likely to happen when you're tired. And some coaches are really worried about if they happen to have – their team happens to play a 10-minute-plus overtime that the following week, they're going to be a little more tired than their opponents. But for the most part, these numbers suggest that it's a really insignificant change, and you know, it's not going to hurt anything, but it's certainly not going to address this issue that they claim is the reason they're doing it.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit like, especially for all the coverage this got, that it's disproportionate to the amount of help it'll actually do, and that it's kind of a PR move more than anything else by the NFL.
Yeah, and one suggestion somebody had, and this happens often when NFL rules are changed. If you look back to the previous season, sometimes there can be like a a blip that something spiked and got everybody all worried and hot and bothered about what was happening. And it did turn out that last year there were 60 plays that happened after the 10-minute mark of the 6 overtime games that went past 10 minutes. And so that was by far more than any of the other years that we ever had numbers for. In some years there was only like 5 or 6 an entire season. So that one year, which was a blip relative to the rest of the 15-year time period we had, is probably what sparked them to do it. I don't think there's any ulterior motive, but they probably got a little
overly worried about 1 year.
Now, Kevin, one of the things that makes it hard for a rule like this to kind of significantly change the number of plays is that the format is sudden death, so you're not sure how long they're going to go. On average, we looked at it, it's about 7.5 minutes since 2012, the rule change.
That overtime has lasted?
Right. But you talked to John Harbaugh on the piece, and he said that one of the things they definitely wanted to keep was sudden death. And like these plays only, or these games only happen about 6% of the time. What's wrong with having a tie 6% of the time? Why can't they get away from sudden death?
You know, it's weird. Like, the tie is just considered an unsatisfying outcome, even though I'm not even convinced, you know, if the worry here is that this will lead to more ties, I'm not even convinced that will happen because, and some of the other coaches I talked to sort of off to the side think the same way. You know, if you know you have 10 minutes in overtime, and score is still tied, you're probably going to accelerate your pace if you have the ball on offense to try to score the same way you would at the end of a fourth quarter. So instead of that period happening in minute 13 of overtime, it'll happen in minute 8. So I'm not even convinced that they're going to have more ties and that the debate over whether they should have sudden death or not will even be that relevant, because I think teams are just going to speed it up a little quicker if a tie is looming. You know, the NFL, in a way, likes having some ties because they help with tiebreakers at the end of the year. But in the end, I don't think that – I wouldn't be shocked if the numbers stay about the same as they have been.
Kevin, real quick, I want to play a take from Mike Golic, another ESPN person who – is sort of making that point, but without numbers. So I just want to play this take real quick.
I don't mind overtime at all, but if we're making this big push for player safety, that's more time they could be injured, more time they're playing, could it affect next week's game if they're playing on a Thursday? If we're so worried about that, then forget it. Don't have overtime. Just get rid of overtime. If you tie, you tie. I don't mind overtime, but if you're making this big stink about player safety and all that, get rid of overtime. Who cares?
So this, to me, gets at sort of the tension within the NFL in general, which is that the league, as I think someone mentioned just a few minutes ago, has had a PR problem around player safety. But it also has a sort of a problem in which the nature of its product can be unsafe at times, and it doesn't want to dilute the nature of its product by having less football for people to watch, or by having football be an arena where there are winners and there are losers, and you know that's what happens. And so it seems to me like something has to give, and what the NFL has chosen to have give is 0.06% of plays.
Yeah, they generally speaking, and listening to you and Golic talk about that, it hits me is that they also have a problem with scale. I mean, the things that they choose to address on a yearly basis, when you step out of the NFL bubble, sometimes seem like extraordinarily insignificant, whether it's that or whether this huge story that came out today about player celebration rules that affects probably 30 plays over the course of a season. It gets this outsized attention, but it's really a very minor part of the game. And sometimes they tend to gnaw at the very edges of things when the real culprits for what we're talking about are left unaddressed. And, you know, Golic mentioned it, not only whether you should have overtime or not, but really the elephant in the room on player safety is Thursday night games. Because if coaches are real and the league is really worried about teams getting their full recovery take away 5 minutes of overtime, and yet they're still going to send them out on 3 days less rest, once a year on Thursday night games. That's a much more significant issue for player safety and player health, I would think, than the last 5 minutes of overtime. So they tend to get really worked up and at the periphery and gnaw at the edges there, and don't want to or just can't address the real looming issues that affect the problems that they've identified.
Now, Kevin, so Thursday night like fascinates me for like all the reasons you're talking about. Is there any way that they can ever address it as like kind of a different sort of competitive environment? Because I was looking and there have been 8 overtime games on Thursday since they changed the rules, which just seems perverse to me. So like if they admit that like maybe we shouldn't have overtime on Thursdays, is that opening the door for, well, maybe we shouldn't have Thursdays?
Yeah, I think they would have it. Would, you know, whether it made sense or not, it would be impossible for them to convince enough coaches and owners to change the basic structure of the game for one night of the year, and have it not affect the rest of the game. So, Thursday nights, will continue as long as they can sell the rights to somebody.
So, Neil, one question I had for you. We, I think, on the show have talked before about rule changes in something like baseball and why baseball can't, right, why Rob Manfred, the commissioner of baseball, can't seem to get through all the rule changes that he wants to get through.
Well, it's a players' union in baseball that seems to be obstructing that.
So, yeah. That's part of my question is why can the NFL tinker in ways that doesn't seem like baseball can? And are we getting a radically more honed product because of that? Because they can tinker a little better. Is it that the owners are unilaterally involved in football and they aren't in baseball?
Well, yeah, I mean the NFL players union is a lot weaker than their counterparts in baseball, and also I think a lot of the changes that are being advocated in at least ostensibly for the sake of player safety, we can kind of debate like we've been doing about how effective they actually address the question of player safety. That's something that is theoretically in the union's interest also, whereas in the case of baseball, there's evidence that, and we're going to run a story this week by our colleague Rob Arthur, that something like time of game, it actually favors the players. Pitchers throw harder when they have more seconds to kind of prepare for each pitch, and older hitters, we've seen evidence that they do better and hit better when they have more time to wait on the pitch as well. So there might be some cross currents there in baseball that you don't see in the other sports. But I do think it's interesting that the NFL, even in a case like this, where it's like they get a lot of media attention for a change that, really doesn't have that much of an effect at all, and only affects a handful of plays, like you're saying, Kevin, that they're willing to tinker in a way that other sports traditionally haven't been, and they're not maybe over tinkering like we've seen in the NHL, for instance, might be the other, you know, extreme of the pendulum where, you know, they decide that they'll give teams a point for losing games and it has all these horrible consequences on the state of the game itself, and they just like put that in there and then they refuse to admit that they've made a mistake, and it's kind of over-meddling by the commissioner's office.
Now, Neil just brought up the NHL, and the NHL like had one of the more extreme changes to overtime where they go short-sighted. It sounds like the NFL wouldn't consider going short-sighted 8-on-8 or something.
8-on-8.
To try to get, you know, short-sighted is going to get more points on the board quicker. If you want to have sudden death, you want to still have overtime, that would end a game much, much quicker. That also might have, you know, different, you know, player safety impacts. But it sounds like that's something like that in the NFL is completely off the board. Is that about right?
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to get to find much interest for the college overtime rule, which, you know, still has 11 guys on each side, but it's just you talk to most people in the NFL, and they say that's not even football to do it the way colleges do it. So it would be hard to expect something more dramatic than what the colleges do, because I don't even think that the NFL would come close to doing that.
And that sounds like it, again, comes back to that tension between the idea of deciding a game no matter what, come hell or high water, we're going to come away with a winner and a loser, and kind of, you know, keeping the purity of the game, even if it means the game drags on longer.
Right, yeah. All right. Kevin Seifert, thanks very much for coming on Hot Takedown. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys.
Okay, now it's time in our show for the significant digit when a telling number from the world of sports arrives. Today, Neil Payne brings that telling number. Neil, what do you have for us?
So my sig dig this week is the number 1.7. That is the number of expected championships that we would think teams from the state of Tennessee would have by now if every team had equal odds of winning in all the leagues each year. And in fact, the state of Tennessee has zero championships, but that could change over the next few weeks.
Are they a rare victoryless state?
They are. Among teams that have ever had a major league franchise, Tennessee is one of only six states that have not won a championship. The others are Utah, Connecticut, Oklahoma, Kentucky, and Iowa. And Kentucky has not had a pro team since the 1926 Louisville Colonels NFL team. Iowa also, Waterloo, Iowa specifically, was a member of the NBA in its first season in 1950. But the other teams in there, Connecticut hasn't had one since 1997 with the Hartford Whalers. Oklahoma only has the Thunder, and they've only been around for less than a decade. So Tennessee is sort of this anomaly. They've had teams in three major sports going back to the early 2000s when the Grizzlies moved from Vancouver to Memphis in 2001. And they also have the Titans and the Predators. And I was going to say this could change over the next few weeks because the Predators won the Western Conference in the NHL, and they'll be playing for the Stanley Cup, and they'll also be playing to end this sort of stealthy, winless drought. We love talking about droughts and winless streaks for teams like the Cleveland Browns, Cleveland in general, the Chicago Cubs, who we just talked about. Not a lot of pub gets given to Tennessee for not winning a pro championship.
All right. Neil. I mean, Kyle, I think I'm going to root for Nashville now in the Stanley Cup playoffs or in the Stanley Cup finals.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and among those other teams that are in the droughts, like Kentucky's, you know, they've got basketball. They're okay.
Right, and you could argue Tennessee has women's basketball. They've won 8 championships there. They've also won 4 football championships. But, you know, college sports being different, I think winning that first pro title is still kind of an interesting accomplishment.
All right. That'll do it for this week's show. Kyle Wagner, thanks for pinch hitting. Appreciate it.
Nice to be here.
Neil Payne. You talked about sports yet again with me for an
hour. Wow. And that is part of a streak of who knows how many consecutive weeks.
Our podcast producer is Katie Ferguson. We got production assistance from Tony Chow and Martin Onebu. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. Find us on your favorite podcasting app, on iTunes, of course, as well. iTunes.com/538. While you're there, be sure to review and or rate the show. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I am Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.